Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As he leaves office, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken will not be remembered as a diplomat. He will be remembered as a moral disgrace. When faced with the chance to stop wars and genocide, he refused. He talked about a rules-based order, but he acted as an international criminal. Crosstalking Blinken's legacy, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Rossi, in Tashkent. He is a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. And here in Moscow, we have Alexander Eitan. He is a lecturer at Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology. Okay, let's start out with Michael in Tashkent. As Anthony Blinken, in his exit interviews, and they were softball ones at that, with the New York Times and the Financial Times, he was singing his own praises, saying America is stronger, its enemies are weaker. He didn't talk about security, which is something remarkable about this administration. It never talked about anyone's security. He thinks he did a bang-up job, and he's very, very pleased with himself passing the baton to the next administration. How will history judge Anthony Blinken? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I have absolutely no doubt that he thinks to himself that he did a bang-up job, and I have no doubt that the New York Times and the Financial Times will judge him as a defender of global liberal democracy. History is going to judge him at best as a very mediocre Secretary of State. As someone who is a little more than a cog in the wheel, a voice, a mouthpiece of the transatlantic liberal system, and one in which I have, as I said before, he has no doubt that he did a successful job, but his name will be connected to a rather unpopular presidency, one that has enabled genocide in the Palestinian territories, another that has been part of a war machine that has perpetuated war in Ukraine against Russia. And I'm sure that the critiques of his administration, of his leadership, will be something that he never really reads. But, you know, at the absolute best, if he's lucky, he'll be considered little more than a footnote.
Yeah, well, I mean, for the rest of us, I hope that justice will catch up with him at some point. We all know that that's unlikely today, but who knows in the future? Alexander, I'm glad that Michael brought up the genocide in the Palestinian territories, but there's also, he sings his praises about the proxy war against Russia, a war that was completely unnecessary and could have been easily avoided. And what's really remarkable, as Anthony Blinken is leaving office, people like Michael Waltz, that'll be the National Security Council advisor in the next administration, is talking about how to undo and end the catastrophe that the Biden administration perpetuated. But he seems completely unconcerned about that. Alexander.
We might ask who Blinken did a good job for, because he certainly did not do a good job for the United States. However, if we look at Israel, I think he did a great job for Israel, and that's probably who is very pleased with his work as well. Remember that at the beginning of the October war between Gaza, between Hamas and Israel, when that started off, Blinken moved his office to Tel Aviv and took up residence in Israel for I don't remember how many weeks, but it's kind of, this is an unprecedented thing for the United States Secretary of State to move to a foreign nation as if he's coordinating efforts there or something. This is quite strange to have from someone who is supposed to represent the interests of the United States and not a foreign power, for example, Israel. We might have to take that into account. And with Mike Waltz, we should also be very careful of him, because in front of a domestic audience, in front of Americans, yes, he's going to say that he wants to undo the damage caused by Blinken, caused by the Biden administration, but we have to consider what he's now saying, which is that he's also supporting the Ukrainians reducing their minimum draft age to 18. So he's calling for the same sorts of things in Ukraine that the Biden administration is calling for right now. So Mike Waltz doesn't care how many Ukrainians are slaughtered in this war on the front lines. For him, it's all just part of the big political game and increasing the Trump administration's leverage in potential negotiations with Russia. So there's actually appears to be very little difference between this incoming Trump administration on the foreign policy front compared to the current Biden administration.
Well, both of you have rapidly moved into the second, what I had hoped to be the second part of the program, but I'm going to go with the flow here. Michael, I mean, I agree. I mean, you have like Keith Kellogg, you know, he's supposed to be the point man for Ukraine, and he's talking about maximum pressure against Iran. I mean, I don't know what administration he's speaking for, the current one or the one that's going to come about. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I mean, as far as Iran is concerned, both the Trump and Biden administrations are in lockstep, right? Iran is public enemy number one when it comes to the Middle East. It's been long regarded as the greatest belligerent, the greatest rival to U.S.-American interests. Netanyahu has long regarded Iran also as one of the biggest obstacles against what he regards as stability. Iran is the enabler of Hezbollah. It propped up the former Assad regime in Syria. So in this step, it's tempting to think that Trump is going to be somehow different from that of the Biden administration when it comes to Iran and the Middle East. The two of them are basically just continuing the same strategy that the United States has been employing within that region since, you know, time immemorial. So, you know, we like to think, many people like to think that Trump is going to be a breath of fresh air against, you know, against the Biden administration in a new sense in American foreign policy. Maybe that would be for Ukraine. I don't know. Right. Ukraine is one story. Trump seems to be eager to end that conflict, to simply redirect all efforts in the Middle East. But when it comes to that, you know, there is very little change between Biden and Waltz, Blinken and Waltz, and between Biden and Trump.
Well, you know, Alexandra, I mean, since Ukraine is being brought up here, I'm just befuddled on how the incoming administration, the individuals we have mentioned here, just continue the same talking points as if they're saying something different. I mean, we had Waltz, he goes on, the bloodshed must come to an end, I'm paraphrasing, of course, must come to an end, this trench warfare must come to an end. But in the same paragraph, they must lower the conscription age in Ukraine. I mean, what is he talking about? That's just more for the meat grinder. I don't know how it's being seen in the United States, but these people are saying, well, it's the same conversation. Maybe it's two sides of the same coin, but it's the same message. Alexander.
Well, I would say that it's not being seen in the United States. The United States has one of the most rigorous and vicious censorship regimes in the entire world. And we have to understand that the American people, by and large, don't really understand what's going on because they're not being told. So, frankly, crosstalk is one of the only available, widely broadcasted places where you can get English language information that is accurate. Everything domestically produced in the United States, it's complete nonsense from either the left or the right. They're both just trying to manipulate their audiences in slightly different ways, but in ways which are always beneficial to the business elites in the United States. And what we're starting to see now is that the American, well, to some extent American, some of them are Americans, but the business elites in the United States hate the American people. There's no other way to describe it. And we look at what Elon Musk and other elements of the new Trump administration are pushing in terms of the H-1B work visa program, trying to bring in who knows how many millions of people from India. Well, we've already flooded the American labor market and destroyed low-skill labor in the United States through immigration from Latin America. So the United States doesn't really need more low-skill immigration, and there isn't a huge pool of labor to draw on for that in Latin America anymore anyway. Most of the people who wanted to get into the United States already have. But who has not gotten into the United States? It's people who could take on sort of tech roles and middle income, middle wage, middle class positions, particularly the sorts of jobs that the H-1B visa program would allow. So the business elites of the United States are going to now use the Trump administration in order to massively increase the number of low-wage workers coming in to displace American workers from the professional class.
This is America First policies. I'm being facetious, of course. That's one of the things we're going to find out. Michael, before we go to the break here, do you remember what Joe Biden said when he was inaugurated, what kind of foreign policy he wanted to have? This is not a trick question. But he said his administration will have a middle-class foreign policy. Do you remember that? What happened to that?
I have to confess, I don't remember that.
Well, we're going to quickly forget the Biden administration. Believe me, keep going.
The one thing I remember is, you know, nothing fundamentally will change. Biden was selected by the Democratic Party to be the gatekeeper of the current neoliberal system. And, you know, to that extent, I think he's been highly successful in providing a platform for the professional managerial class to continue to exert leverage over that working class that he claims to still think that he comes from.
Well, I mean, Michael, the PMCs, I'm glad you brought it up here, because as we move forward, next week we will have the next president of the United States, the 47th. But it seems to me that they're trading one set of oligarchs and billionaires for another set, because I don't see... I didn't see in the last 4 years a middle-class foreign policy, and I don't see a MAGA foreign policy because of the people that Trump has around him. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt myself. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Anthony Blinken's legacy. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Blinken's legacy. Okay, let's go back to Alexander. I mean, one of the things that is quite fascinating to watch, or maybe banal, depending on how you want to look at it, is that, you know, we had an election in November, in many ways kind of world historic. We've never seen this kind of political comeback, considering the establishment's lawfare against Trump, its control of the media, Hollywood, of academia, et cetera, et cetera. And he still came out on top, almost like a Lazarus figure, and he won the popular vote, okay? And so I usually don't invoke on this program Barack Obama, but I will. Elections have consequences, or at least they should. And I think that, you know, what we've seen since the election to the point that we're talking right now is that, you know, the Trump team on spring break, they're having a wonderful time. Their parents gave them credit cards, and they're having a wonderful time. But it's going to get very, very sober next week. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, we have to consider who won the 2024 election, because we have to remember that the 2020 election was stolen. And a lot of people in the United States are living in a fairyland where they've just decided to forget that Trump won the 2020 election but was denied the office. Well, now in 24, somehow the Democrats managed to get 6 million fewer votes than in 2020. How did this happen? Well, we know that something on the order of 15 million fake votes were created in order to get Biden the presidency. And so this time, the Democrats just didn't do that. So why? Well, the only logical explanation is that Trump made a deal with people who have the influence to prevent the Democratic Party machine from stealing another presidential election when they already control the executive office. So they had everything going for them, and they just decided to let it go.
Well, I mean, but Alexander, in all fairness, I'm not going to disagree with you, but in all fairness, the Trump's victory was so overwhelming that it was really hard to deny, and we didn't have the conditions of COVID as well, which is an important caveat here. But I get your point here. Let me go back to Michael and Tashkent. I'm returning to Blinken in an important way here. One of the things that the Biden administration did with its foreign policy is it really turned the United States into a pariah on the world stage. Americans don't know this. They're not aware of this here. But the culpability of the Biden administration with the genocide is not going to go away ever. Go ahead, in Tashkent, ever.
You know, I've been thinking about whether or not people like Biden and Blinken are directly complicit within this genocide. And I know that this is a very controversial word to use, but that's exactly what it is. I would say at absolute best, people like Blinken and Biden are directly complicit because this is the actions and the decisions of the Israeli state and the Israeli government. But they're enablers. They're defenders at the international front. Economically speaking, they provide Israel with carte blanche support. Militarily, diplomatically, at the UN Security Council, Israel would not be able to do what it does without the complete support from the United States. And we need to be very clear that next week, when Trump takes over, this is not going to change.
Exactly. Exactly. It is not going to change. I very rarely go on Twitter X, or whatever it's called these days, but I warned everyone that, you know, you can have a good feeling right now, but we could go from easily Genocide Joe to Genocide Don. And it's going to happen because the world is not going to see it differently. Donald Trump is not some great hope to change the world. What people are hoping is that maybe he will start adjusting American foreign policy that would be in the interest of the American middle class, as I pointed out at the first part of the program here. So, Alexander, you know, this is what we are faced right now, because there's going to be a huge disappointment. And I would even wager to say within the MAGA movement. Go ahead.
Donald Trump is beholden to his donors. And he took $100 million from Miriam Adelson, reportedly in exchange for commitments on supporting an Israeli annexation of the West Bank. $100 million is not something that Trump can just walk away from. He needed it. And he's going to need the support of these people in order to be able to get anything done, whatever he may try to get done in this administration. So we have to understand also the direction of the relationship between the United States and Israel. The United States does not necessarily support Israel. Rather, we should understand the United States is a vassal state of Israel. We saw when Bibi Netanyahu came to Washington, he got a record number of standing ovations. Practically every sentence he said in Congress, it was a standing ovation for longer than the sentence took to say. It was absolutely ridiculous. It was disgusting to see a foreign leader applauded in this way when he's carrying out this genocide in the Middle East, attacking multiple countries. And this is what the United States has been reduced to. It's a vassal state of Israel. And Trump understood that, to his credit, perhaps from a campaigning perspective, and took advantage of it during his campaign. And now we're going to reap the consequences of that during his administration.
You know, Michael, Alexander brings up a good point. I don't necessarily agree. I mean, as a vassal of state, it seems to me that the American foreign policy wants continued hegemony, particularly in the Middle East. And Israel is its proxy. And, well, they commit a genocide, but they continue our hegemony. I think it's more like that kind of relationship right there. It's, you know, it's because the Americans want to maintain hegemony and deny countries like Iran influence, they're willing to go along with the most grotesque acts that humans can commit against each other. That's more or less how I look at it. What are your thoughts, Michael?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on this. There's this big debate as to who controls who. You know, some camps believe that Israel controls the United States. Others say that the United States is the one that ultimately uses Israel as a proxy. I'm of the mind in which American foreign policy, regardless of Democrat or Republican in the White House, follows the same strategy and the same policies within strategic areas like the Middle East. Within the study of international relations, we have a model called commitment theory, or commitment problems. It's largely written by the great IR theorist James Fearon. In other words, the United States is committed to propping up, defending certain states and certain policies in regions around the world. Let's just use Israel as a good example of this. Iran is the bad guy, Israel is the good guy. And it doesn't matter what Israel does, Iran does, it is much more prudent for the United States to continue with the same policy than completely reversing tactics, making it look like we are now suddenly abandoning our ally, despite the fact that the ally is now committing grotesque acts of, well, multiple war crimes, not just in the Palestinian territories, but also in southern Lebanon. They are now just openly occupying large areas of southern Syria. If they just simply annex it along with the Golan Heights, I am very doubtful that American foreign policy will condemn this in the same way that they condemn Russia's annexation of territories in Ukraine, simply because of the fact that it makes more sense to continue down the path that you are on than to do a complete 180 and seem like you are now abandoning your allies because of the new administration or just new geopolitical realities.
You know, it's very interesting, Alexander, the calling card of Anthony Blinken during the past disastrous 4 years was the rules-based order. And it was really interesting because the Americans got all their minions in Europe to start mimicking it over and over again as if it had some kind of meaning. But what we have is a rules disorder at the end of this administration. We all agree here that there is continuity. Would a Obama administration or a Bush administration tolerate genocide? We don't know, okay? That's only a hypothetical thing here. But to gloss it over in the rules-based order, I certainly hope that that term is forever retired. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yeah, I think that America has not been taken very seriously by the adults in the room, like Russia, China, and other emerging economies around the world. When the Secretary of State flies around the world and all he produces is a bunch of slogans designed for domestic consumption in America, it's very embarrassing, very embarrassing. But you see that when Blinken was in D.C., he would be simply doing the jobs that Israel would send him. So his job was to run cover for Netanyahu.
Alexander, I mean, the phrase is he was Israel's lawyer, right?
Right. So he's giving press conferences and explaining that a ceasefire is very close. Oh. Netanyahu has agreed to a ceasefire. And that very same day, Netanyahu has already announced that he will not agree to any ceasefire. Obviously, the administration knew that. Obviously, Blinken knew that. And yet they went and said it. So what could this be except for domestic propaganda purposes or just to confuse people or confuse some observers as to how disconnected they could be? But we know they cannot be this disconnected. They're in regular communication.
Okay, Michael, we have one last minute here. I'm going to be a little provocative with you. I started out the program by claiming that Anthony Blinken wasn't a diplomat. Does that make you, considering his tenure, does that make you miss Henry Kissinger?
No.
Okay.
Oh, God. Please, no. I'll just leave it at that. No.
My point is, and I'm obviously being provocative here, Michael. But you know, Nixon going to China, things like that. This is what diplomats do. I mean, there's a lot of collateral damage, obviously. But that was thinking strategically about the national interest, even if we disagree with the outcomes. But the point is that, and I think it's already been mentioned here, is that now the Secretary of State is just a cog in the works, and diplomacy has no role in American foreign policy, unfortunately. And I don't think it's going to change. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Tashkent and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.